once again, this is the Library Show. I'm your host this morning, Sarah Bell. I do share the duties with two other people, and in fact, Brooke Schaefer is here in the studio with me as well. And but I think she'll be sort of doing commentary. And I do want to mention that the library is moving. And I think not only are they moving, they're changing their name. So really getting a fresh start in 2016. And I'm certain that it's a huge process to move the entire collection and everything else that goes along with stuff at the library, that they might appreciate volunteering. That is, you volunteering, and food's always good to bring by. So if you want to help out, do call the library. I think the number's still 747-8708, offer to pitch in a little bit or maybe drop some food or treats or beverages by. So that's the news from the library, and I guess we'll get to the heart of the show and let you know that our guest today is Alfonso Gallo, and Brooke Schaefer is also going to sit in as a guest. So I guess we'll just start by saying let's do a few introductions. And I was very official in introducing you as Alfonso Gallo. Welcome, but I want to know a little bit more about your name.
Well, as Paul Simon once wrote in a song, "You Can Call Me Al," which was the hit single off the album Graceland, and how that came about, and it's very current. That's the only reason I asked you to introduce me as Alfonso. This last week, we lost two music pioneers, David Bowie and also Pierre Boulez. And Pierre Boulez, French conductor and composer, was at a party in New York in the 80s, and Paul Simon and his wife, who at that time was Peggy Harper, were at the party. And they were introduced to Pierre. And throughout the night, every time Pierre talked to Mr. Simon and his wife, he referred to Paul as Al, and he referred to Peggy, his wife, as Betty. So Paul went home that night and wrote the song, "You Can Call Me Al."
That's a good story. Can we call you Al?
You betcha.
All right. Well, Al is a wonderful library user and has, I'm sure, some things to talk about. So let's open it by saying, what do you have in your book bag, Al?
Well, I have a group of books. I have Gretel Ehrlich's book, The Solace of Open Spaces. I have a book that's quite current, and it's called Weed the People: The Future of Legal Marijuana in America, written by a man named Bruce Barcott.
And which seems pretty timely for Alaska.
Yeah, quite timely. Matter of fact, I was mentioning to Brooke out in the waiting area, I have talked to two folks that are on the commission in town, and they are going to get the book and read it. It's a great primer. It's a book for people who have used marijuana. It's also a great book for people who have not. So I strongly encourage anybody who wants to have any information, because it's here, folks.
Right.
So, you know, either you're going to learn about it or you're just going to be left in the dark. I have the book that we talked about also out in the waiting room, and I just finished this book. It was funny. I was reading Ashley's War at the same time I was reading Kim Gordon's book. Kim was in a group called Sonic Youth. And the difference between those two was like night and day. Here's a very successful woman, an artist, a poet, a rock musician, and then Ashley's War, who Ashley was attached to the Rangers in Afghanistan and was a true warrior.
A pretty dangerous situation to be attached to the Rangers.
Yeah, yeah,
a young woman, I would assume.
Although, you know, it's amazing. This woman was 5'3", and they went through 100 days of training. There was like 500 women that applied for these. There were cultural support teams was the official name, and they had over 500 volunteers, narrowed it down to a group. These women went through like 100 days of training, intense physical training, weapons training, And then they were assigned to Rangers, and then she went over to Afghanistan. Very emotional book. It's really hard for me to talk about it and not get emotional.
Right. Well, you were yourself in Vietnam, is that correct?
Yes, I was there in 1968.
Okay, so that must bring maybe some raw memories to the surface.
I think so. I have a great appreciation for people who serve their country.
Right.
I really do. I also have a book, Gordon Haber's book, the late Gordon Haber, who studied wolves in Denali for 42 years before he died in a tragic plane crash studying the wolves. This book is fascinating. I knew Gordon. Matter of fact, I'll tell another short story. My first winter in Denali, I was house-sitting with a woman named Marisa James. We were living on the McKinley Village airstrip, and in exchange for sweeping off the plains, we had this dilapidated old cabin that was just leaked like a sieve, two stories. And I remember waking up Thanksgiving morning and going down looking at the thermometer outside, and it was 50 below.
I think I lived in a cabin much like that in Kotzebue. You know, the chinking between the logs was just about, shirt rags from shirts that had been torn up. And needless to say, lots of air came through that.
But we went over on Solstice Day in 1974. Gordon Haber's cabin sat, his cabin is on the west side of the George Parks Highway and sits down in the Nanana River Canyon. Really beautiful spot, but it's kind of nice because you can see the sun, and that time of year up there, you see the sun about 45 minutes. So Marisa and I went over, and Marisa was like, oh, we can sit on Gordon's porch, and we cleared off the snow off the porch. It was 38 below. We sat on the porch, we drank tea, and we watched the sun come through the mountains and down, because we were looking south towards Cantwell. Saw the sun, it came through the valley and then disappeared through the mountains, and that was it. But this book is fascinating. Gordon loved wolves. He was irascible. A lot of people don't like Gordon Haber. I thought he was, every time you talked to him, you could just tell he had that pure love about wolves, and I definitely would like to read something
out
of this.
You know, why don't we just do that?
Okay.
Since we were sort of
talking about it, yeah.
Why not?
And it's kind of early on in the book, which is kind of cool.
Always. You know, when you want to be able to jump right to that spot.
Yeah, I know. And I should have marked it. I put markings in the other books.
Well, while you look, I will mention, it's going to, I think, as the half hour evolves and it's quickly evolving, it's interesting to know how many things Al has done. And we were talking a little bit. He has discovered that the CD collection at the public library also is sometimes, you find little nuggets. And he was also worked as a, what would you call it, a roadie or as technical support for
stagehand
Bonnie Raitt and one of my favorite singers. So what a breadth of experience. But did you find your spot?
No, I didn't yet. So you know what maybe we could do,
sure.
Since you were talking about the music?
Yes.
A lot of times when I go to the library, I'm sure other people do it, but I always go through the CDs because there's a wealth of CDs there. And one of the times gone through, I found a CD by a group called the L.A. Blues Alliance. And I was like, I don't know who these folks are. So I opened the CD. And, of course, I knew half the people in there had worked with a couple of them. And then the guy who produced it was a guy named Mike Post. And Mike had 3 Grammys and 1 Emmy. But he wrote the music for, among other things, Hill Street Blues, The Rockford Files, Law and Order, NYPD, L.A. Law, Theme for Magnum, St. Elsewhere, and the Cop Files. So
really sort of every major crime show on detective show on television. So should we go ahead and just play, I think we're going to play track 7?
Track 7, and we can talk a little bit about it maybe afterwards.
Okay, and you can find that passage.
Yeah, sorry.
No problem.
I keep a close watch on this heart of mine. I keep my eyes wide open all the time. I keep the ends out for the chance of mine. That's because you're mine.
Well, that's a great one.
Yeah, it's definitely a different rendition of a great Johnny Cash song, I Walk the Line.
Yeah.
And that the vocals on that, I'm sure anybody who listens to blues music, that's Amy Keys is in there. And I want to say Keb Moe, but, you know, I might be wrong. I think that might be Mike Finnegan on the vocals. Let me, as I'm talking, I'm looking. Yeah, that's Mike Finnegan. Scene with Amy and Mike Finnegan, as I told you, he's out on tour right now with Bonnie, doing her piano work, and he's an amazing. I love his vocals, but this is a great CD.
It is a great CD.
Keb Moe's on it, Finnegan, Stanley Behrens, who is one of the best harmonica players around, Sonny Landreth, who is a excellent slide guitar player, just a whole bunch of good people.
Okay,
before we keep going, I want to know if you can talk a little bit about, though, working for Bonnie Raitt, Al. Like, how long did you do that? What did you do exactly? What was that like?
Well, I was a stagehand in the Twin Cities. I went to the Twin Cities in 78. I went to radio and television school and luckily had a great mentor, who took care of me and watched out for me and got me jobs in the Twin Cities. But I was a stagehand in the Twin Cities, so I worked with a lot of musicians. But I did some stuff at a radio station in the Twin Cities, KFAI, Fresh Air Radio. And similar to what we're doing here at KCAW.
Yeah.
And one of the people who worked there was a great piano player, and produced Bonnie's first album, which was produced out in Lake Minnetonka. Man named Willie Murphy, who I used to go see him every Friday nights on a little dive bar down in the, and he used to do music by Little Richard and stuff like that. But yeah, Bonnie was great. But I worked with a bunch of people. I probably stagehand for almost 30 years. I actually did some up in Talkeetna. Got to work with people like the Waylon Jennies, Baca Beyond. Trying to think who else. Oh, the group from Nigeria. I'll think of it. I'm having what we call a senior moment here.
Well, I'm anxious to get on to Among Wolves. So did you find the passage?
I sure did.
All right.
Yeah. And like I said, Gordon was such an advocate for the Wolves. Okay. The intimacy between wolves in a family group, which enables them to cooperate closely, also means that each is keenly aware of the identity and presence or absence of others. From what I have seen, the intimacy of a family group is often comparable to and sometimes exceeds the degree of intimacy found within a typical human family. Wolves will go to great effort to remain with their families. And not speaking for anybody else, but looking at my own family background, I have to agree totally with Gordon. And I think I've...
So, I was just letting us know that we only have 15 minutes left, which is stunning. But that sounds like a wonderful book, Among Wolves, because I think there's always great curiosity about wolves.
Did you have much experience with them yourself living up in Talkeetna? Like, did you view wolves up there? Or?
Not so much in Talkeetna, but when I worked in Denali National Park, I had the great fortune to live out on the Toklat River. I worked on the road crew there. You know, as you know, there's a 92-mile road that goes into Denali that's only open in the summer. And I lived at one of the road camps that was put in when the Alaska Road Commission built the road. It took them 13 years to build 92 miles. And they established camps. Well, I lived at Toklat, and I used to go out at night after the buses would leave. There was a woman that worked for, at that time, was the Alaska Natural History Association, which is now Alaska Geographic. But we'd walk out and stand on the bridge, and the Toklat is like many rivers in the interior. It's braided. And I remember one time, I mean, we had wolves, bears through camp all the time. But one really memorable occasion was we were up on the bridge, and there was a young wolf and a young bear, and they were chasing each other. And they were gone across the braids and chasing each other. And they'd go across, and one would turn, and the other one would turn, and they'd chase. And they did this for like a half an hour, and we just sat there mesmerized. And then they just split off and went their separate ways. So, yeah, my first year driving on the road, I kept the journal. I had 28 wolf encounters. So in 5 years, I probably saw well over 100 wolf encounters. So got to see them pretty up close and personal, which was phenomenal.
Well, you know, you mentioned Toklat, and we work. I don't think we'll spend time talking about it, except it reminds me that the Kim Heacock's book, what's the title on that one, the new one?
Rhythm of the Wild.
Rhythm of the Wild. He starts out on the, he goes in for training, I think, as a ranger, a park.
Correct.
Park ranger. And so the day before he is supposed to report, early in the morning, he decides to ride his bicycle on that road towards Toklat. And, you know, most roads in interior Alaska are pretty rugged. And so it's his adventure about trying to get his bicycle up and down and over rocks and then in turn to be able to turn around and get back because somebody ends up giving him a lift. Well, of course, it's great to have a lift towards Toklat. I don't think he made it that far. But then he realized he had to turn around and ride all the way back. And that's kind of how that book starts.
So. Yeah, you can tell Kim's love of the book really comes through. You know, I had mentioned to you David James, who lives up in Fairbanks and who I knew from Denali, wrote a review about the Rhythm of the Wild, and he compared Heacock's love of Denali with Muir's love of Yosemite.
Right.
So
it's a good read, and Kim Heacock, I believe, lives in Gustavus most of the year. Which is very near the entrance to Glacier Bay. But he's just a delightful writer. You know, he's an Alaskan writer who's way up there with anybody publishing anywhere, I think. And he writes with great voice. You know, you feel like he's sitting right next to you telling his story. So I won't, you know, I haven't read all the way through the book, but I'm looking forward to being able to do that. So we need to move along, and I would like you to talk about, yes.
Ashley's War.
Yes.
Yeah, it's, you know, it's a hard story to talk about because it's just, I found it so entrancing. It just, her love of her country combined with, she was tenacious. She's a very tenacious woman, and part of a team. Her husband was in the military, and I just, you know, it's hard for me to talk about because it was really very emotional read for me. But
and who is the author, just for listeners' sake?
A woman named Gail, and I'm not going to try and pronounce her middle name. I will spell it. It's T-Z-E-M-A-C-H, and the last name is Lemon. And she's a senior fellow at the Council on Foreign Relations, and she contributes to The Atlantic. So, you know, it's somebody who has written about defense issues, and she does an amazing job. It's an amazing read, from Ashley finding out that they were going to have this cultural support teams that were going to assist the Rangers because there was a need for the Army. A lot of times when they would go out and do these nighttime raids, there would be children and women present, and the Army saw right away that there was a need for somebody to be able to not only communicate, but also to show a little bit less military side, not to denigrate what they did, because these women were tough and are tough. You know, it just was, as of January 2016 now, it's official in the Department of Defense that women can assume combat roles. So,
and yet they've been in combat. I mean, because I read there was a Christian Science Monitor, I think, had a lengthy article on these young women who were taken in as soldiers for the, you know, doing what Ashley did, but they were in the thick of things often, and they would wear the headscarves because male military army soldiers were not able to communicate with the women. The women were not free to talk with them. And so, like you said, it became immediately apparent to the Army that if they were going to be able to converse at all with women and children, they needed women in their ranks. But it often put those women in pretty, not desperate, but pretty military situations, I guess.
So oh, if yeah. I understand correctly, then her role was not as a soldier initially. Her role was to go into places, though, where soldiers were fighting, and to people like Ashley from this book. And her job was to communicate with the people that weren't engaged in the fighting.
Yeah, I mean, they were primarily a peacekeeping role, but they all carried weapons. And if under fire would be, like Sarah was saying, you know, it was kind of a gray area initially in Iraq and in Afghanistan, but many women came under combat situations. You know, having been exposed to fire, you can't be in a war zone and not be exposed to fire. And it's, you know, it's a very frightening thing, but this group of women were just amazing. I couldn't put the book down. I read it in 2 days. You know, it was one of those books you start and you go, wow, I've got to finish this one.
Okay, well, let's move on to something else from your book bag.
Okay, you know what I did bring too? I brought I love when I'm reading, I find quotes in books. So I put them on notes, and if you look at my refrigerator, you can't find the refrigerator. So I'd like to, can I read one of these to you?
Yeah, we have 5 minutes left.
Yeah, this is real short. This is out of a science fiction book. It's called The Book of Heaven by Gregory Benford and Larry Niven. And it's a quote from the Captain Redwing, who was a commander of the Sunseeker. And Red Wing had always thought that life's journey wasn't to get to your grave safely in a well-preserved body, but rather to tumble in, wrecked, shouting, "What a ride." And I just love that, because that's my philosophy. This body is not for saving.
And what book is that out of?
It's out of a book called Book of Heaven, Gregory Benford and Larry Niven, both established science fiction. I love reading science fiction.
Oh, yeah, Larry Niven for sure. I know him well.
Yeah.
Well, we have time probably for one more, and I was thinking that that, yes, might be one that would be, you know, really
yeah,
fun to talk
about. Yeah, you know,
but
I didn't pick anything out of reading for this, unfortunately.
That's okay. Tell us about it.
Yeah, I mean, I'm kind of curious if that book is something you mentioned that you passed it on to a couple of people who are on the commission here in Sitka. So I'm curious if it, like, gives guidance. The book is, that we're talking about is Weed the People.
Yeah, what I liked about it, Bruce Barcott, the man who wrote this, he writes for the Times, Rolling Stone, National Geographic. He's a family man, and he had very mixed feelings. He was living in Washington, and initially was going to vote no on the referendum, but then went into the research for this book and became, should we say, a convert?
Yeah.
But he did his homework. I mean, this covers growing. It just covers everything.
Okay. And so do you feel like it gives people information to think about the up-and-coming changes?
Absolutely. Yeah, I think it's a great read. Having talked to several folks, because there's folks on the commission who have not used marijuana, and that's fine. You know, I think you need a good cross-section, but I also think that you should have knowledge of what you're talking about, and that's what I really liked about this book. You know, the title, Weed the People, The Future of Legal Marijuana in America, and he talks about the people who grow it, the people who make the edibles, he goes to conferences. It's just really a well-written book and I don't think there's any preconceived stuff in here. He went in pretty open-minded. So
I'm curious if there's time for you to say if you got a sense of why he became a convert. Like, why does he kind of explain why he's changed his mind and thinks that it should be legal, or is it woven throughout too much to...
No, I think partially it was the people he met, you know, the entrepreneurs. There is a lot of, obviously, money involved in this. I mean, what did I read? Colorado last year, $100 million was contributed towards the economy. So he just, I think he just was impressed by, I think the average person who thinks about somebody who smokes marijuana thinks, oh, they're a pothead. Well, you know what? That's not always the case. And I think that's why I enjoyed Bruce's book, because I think he went in with that feeling, but he definitely came out not with that feeling.
Does he talk at all about other experiences of other countries, for example, the Netherlands?
A little bit.
Of other places?
A little bit, Sarah, but not a whole lot.
I'm going to ask Brooke to kind of come around to the board.
Okay.
To help us with our transition. after this program, we're almost at 11 o'clock, which tells me that we almost have to say a quick goodbye. Time just has escaped us. We'll have you back. Will you come back?
Oh, I'd love to come back. It was fun. Thank you very much, Sarah and Brooke. Thank you.
Okay. And you have been listening to The Library Show on KCAW Raven Radio right here in Sitka, Alaska. And we hope that you'll come back next week, same time, same place. And coming up, we have the TED Radio Hour from 11 to noon. Thanks for listening.